Okay, I think we're going to begin. So welcome all to this afternoon's event. My name is Louise Arimatsu. I'm with the Centre for Women, Peace and Security here at the IRC. A couple of housekeeping matters. First of all, can I remind you to switch your mobiles either off or on silent mode, please? If the fire alarm does go, Daniel in the back, who is with the library, will enlighten us as to what we need to do, so please follow his instructions. Now, today's event is part of a series that the Centre for Women, Peace and Security has hosted with the LSE Library around the theme, Giving Peace a Chance. These events have been made possible for us, certainly by the AHRC, the Arts and Humanities Research Council, and the European Research Council, which have funded two specific projects located within the centre, a Feminist International of Peace and Security, and a Gender Peace. Now, both these projects give my colleagues, who are sitting there at the back, and me an opportunity to think about the intersection of peace and international law through feminist methodologies. As an international lawyer, I've spent the best part of my career thinking about the intersection of violence and war with international law, rather than grapple with perhaps a more difficult or complex idea of peace, let alone a feminist peace, a gendered peace. Now, the broader aim, and maybe this will come as a bit of a shock to my colleague Christine Schinken, who's sitting there, the broader aim, I think, of what our project is trying to do is to reposition international law's discourse around peace rather than war, and more specifically, as I said, a feminist or gendered peace. So through these projects, I've had the privilege of meeting, talking with, and learning from some remarkable women who have been at the forefront of peace activism from across the globe. Some are working in war zones, others in highly volatile environments, and still others are active in so-called peaceful environments. The risks they take differ widely depending on the context, but it is always gendered. Their experiences are different. After all, women are not a homogenous group, as I'm sure this particular event will demonstrate. Now, given the limited time that we have, I'm not going to go through individual speakers' biographies. I'm sure, you know, we've circulated the biographies with you, and you will know that each one of my guests are extraordinary women, and all three are experts in their respective fields. Insofar as format is concerned, I've asked our speakers, Nina Ansari, who's sitting on my left, and then Dana Kaya, who's sitting on my right, and Lola, Lola Koda, who's sitting on my far left, to first tell us a little bit more about peace women, about women's peace activism or movements in their respective countries, namely Iran, Iraq, and Syria, and to share their insights with us. We will then spend a few minutes or some time in conversation amongst the panelists before then opening up to with an exchange with yourselves. Now, before I hand over to our speakers, I want to add one more thing. To peace, and who will be sharing with us an alternative understanding and vision of peace. So over to you, Nina.
Okay. Thank you very much, Louise. Thank you very much for having me. I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak about the women of Iran. Just to provide you with a very brief political, social, and historical landscape, as Iran has has a tendency to have a convoluted one, and periods in history where women in Iran were relatively free to determine their own lives, and then only to have that taken back by depending on who is the reigning entity in power at the time. Women's peace activism in Iran currently is primarily centered on regaining their rights, meaning regaining the rights that they had lost prior to the advent of the Islamic Republic. So the main objective for the last four decades since the Islamic Republic has come to power is for women, and I mean women from all walks of life, you're talking millions of women at the forefront of activism, to reverse the gender discriminatory laws. And what they are up against is formidable in the sense that you have Sharia law, which is embedded in the Islamic constitution. You have a society which regards women as subordinate and inferior in status, and that inferiority and subordination has in effect been embedded in the Islamic constitution. So you have women who are not only resisting these laws via their peaceful activism, and later on I'll get into the various methodology these women are resorting to in order to regain their rights, but the fact that you're dealing with a state apparatus that is not averse to resorting to violence and handing harsh sentences to these women for everything from imprisonment to lashes. So this is the current landscape in Iran. Just recently, the World Bank came out with a statistic, and Iran unfortunately ranks near bottom of the World Bank's index on gender equality, coming in at 185 out of the 187 countries in the study, just behind Saudi Arabia and Sudan. But despite that, you have a female population in Iran that currently is highly educated. Women surpass men in higher education. Currently, two-thirds of all university students in Iran are women. This has been one avenue for towards their own autonomy within this patriarchal system, and also an empowering medium. As we all know, education is very empowering. So when the revolution happened, approximately 35% of university students were women. Today, over 80% of university students are women. But despite that, they are dealing with a system that systematically discriminates women in practically every sector, including the job market. Unfortunate reality is you have many educated women in recent years who have had to resort even to prostitution as an avenue to get out of poverty. But on the other hand, you also have a resilient female population who have actually, despite their situation, excelled beyond their circumstances. Iran, in the last decade alone, we have had women who are award-winning filmmakers, award-winning athletes, award-winning journalists, award-winning architects, even the first woman to ever win the Fields Medal, also known as the Nobel Prize of Mathematics, was a woman born and raised in the Islamic Republic who went on to become a renowned professor at Stanford University, the late Maryam Mirzakhani, who is no longer with us. I think I should stop and give everyone else, but just to give you the current situation in contemporary period.
Would you like to?
Sure. So I have 5 minutes and I will keep it short as well. Iraq is a context of conflict, long-term conflict, and types of war, from international war, Iran-Iraq war, and then sectarian violence, intervention, ISIS, radical extremism. It's a very, it's a conflict context with different types of and levels of violence going on. So. And it's also a context in which women's rights activism has a long history, going back to the 1950s, even longer. And they have pushed the women's rights agenda consistently. And since 2003, after the intervention, the number of civil society organizations working on women's rights have increased substantially. So this is, again, a context in which legal discrimination against women is quite pervasive in the legal, in the penal criminal code, in the personal status law. In terms of political participation, the parliament has a 25% quota, and in terms of level of education, the situation, I think the level of education among the female population have gone down since, because of partly related to the conflict, but also because of the insecurity, infrastructural issues, and in terms of social and economic rights, there's a decline in women's situation in Iraq, and this is mainly because of the conflict and other reasons. So what's happening in terms of peace? So when we talk about peace, immediately the traditional mentality and security mentality makes us think about the opposite of war. You know, conciliation, reconciliation between the warring sides, or peace deals, and women's ability to take part in these reconciliations, in these negotiations that are happening at the top level between the warring sides. But as we know, women's security needs and priorities are different from the traditional international actors and national actors focus on and they mainly focus on state security. And the main discourse from an international perspective on Iraq and the donors' perspective is also not necessarily open-minded. They're focus on women's participation is mainly descriptive participation, so how many women are there in the parliament, how many women in this, but it's not substantive. They don't focus on substantive participation, and they have stereotype perceptions about what women do in Iraq and their role. There's also lots of presumptions about women's needs and priorities and roles in conflict, in displacement, in politics. And Iraq is a context, you know, there are multiple religions, it's a big geography, and the experiences of women in different geographies, from different social backgrounds, economic backgrounds, and exposure to violence, all these, there's a huge variation. So usually the international donors are lumping women into one category. I will talk about very briefly formal and informal peace building. So in terms of formal peace building in Iraq, women, despite the 25% quota and women's, you know, women being part of the parliament and certain political positions, there is no women in formal peace building processes in Iraq. In, for instance, 2006, after the intervention, the Iraqi government adopted a national reconciliation program and formed the National Reconciliation Commission. Women were not part of this. Instead, they formed a separate office for women in the National Commission, which was weak and ineffective, and then it was closed later. In 2017, a new attempt was made by UNAMI and UN Women, the attempt and the Iraqi government to include women in this National Reconciliation Committee. So far, not much progress. And in Iraq, peace building relies on tribal hierarchy, religious leaders, and the political elite. So they are the key figures in these peace building processes, and they are the areas that's quite hard women to infiltrate to be part of. So in practice, women who could promote women's interests and have a history of campaigning on women's rights and participation and have a different perspective on peace are not part of these processes, and international community is not really doing much to include them. Women's civil society organizations are pushing for women to be part of these formal peace-building processes. They have been campaigning, they have been organizing events at international level, at the local level, also carrying out, you know, trainings and capacity-building work. That is going on. There are also very localized, small peace-building efforts done by women themselves. Again, very much overlooked. So it's kind of, in Iraq, you see this other informal peace-building process that had emerged since 2003, and that's mainly led by the civil society organization. It's not an ideal context, civil society context in Iraq. It's hybrid. So women have utilized the space and the funding going into women's issues in Iraq and formed their organizations, raised their agendas, and carried on working on these issues. and they address security concerns, make efforts to overcome sectarian ideas, and have a longer-term transformational perspective. But they also have become the implementers of the international agendas because of their dependency on funding. And there's also a lot of politics of civil society going on. So it's a hybrid place. But nonetheless, they do push for activism. And civil society in Iraq has become a context for women's political activism because they are not necessarily part of the other peace-building processes. And they do have a different understanding of peace, which focuses on rebuilding the society, increasing capacity, and eliminating discrimination against women, tackling disarmament. And so all those different issues, not traditionally considered as peace and security and security related. So they do work on these more community focused areas that are actually part of the wider conception of peace and should be part of the conception of peace. So there is much neglect of this informal peacekeeping processes going on in Iraq by the international community and national actors, and they should be tapped on. And I think I spoke more than 5 minutes. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm sure no one in here wanted you to stop, actually. But we're going to come back to you. Leila, would you like to tell us a little bit about what's going on in Syria?
Yes. Over to Syria. I think Syria is a very good manifestation of the clash between a slowly developing international law with all its issues around application, around how binding it is, versus at the same time a very fast-paced, largely unregulated, hugely funded arms trade and development in the use of arms in armed conflict. And unfortunately, when the situation in Syria has only, I mean, interventions and analysis has only been concerned with the period from the from when it was declared an international armed conflict, which happened almost a year after an uprising started, a pacifist, peaceful uprising started, where women were heavily involved. It was the first chance in over four decades for people to go to the streets and demand change in so many ways that has been impacting their lives. Unfortunately, this has been faced with very heavily militarized, violent reaction by the government, and international reactions to that have been quite limited, confused, I'd say, and unfortunately left the Syrian civilian population, mainly women, alone. And women were facing a disproportionate impact of this course of events. And the huge use of violence against civilians meant that pacifist means of activism have been very limited. And the price for these have been very, very high. We still are dealing with an issue of detention and torture, which is fast in Syria. There's people who are still detained after 8 years of that one demonstration that they went into demanding reform or demanding change. Unfortunately, the international community, and I'm talking about state actors and non-state actors, have not been able to deal with the repercussions, with the violent repercussions of civilians' activism, largely pacifist. And then we came to try and solve the problem when this activism got armed and moved on from there, and all the problems that comes with arming, ideological problems, practical problems, and so on. It's very hard to solve a problem when you come at the second or third stage of it, when both international law but also international positions, state and non-state actors' position, have failed to address the causes and the ways it has been handled to start with. So the limitation of the responsibility to protect, the limited ability to show solidarity with the Syrian people, and a limited understanding of the universality of human rights meant the Syrian people, particularly women, have paid a huge price for an uprising that was going to happen at one point. So if I want to mention a few characteristics of women's peaceful activism and work towards peace, towards peace in Syria, I'd say that it was largely organic. It's not a region, and I work across the region. And one thing I've seen in common between Syria and other countries in conflict is that, particularly in the case of Syria, addressing their work as work for peace is very, very limited. That's for so many reasons. One of them is the I'd say, the bad reputation of peace work. In Arabic, the two actions that working for peace bring to mind is the peace deal with Israel, which hasn't gave people many rights, and the peace after the Lebanese war, which meant no accountability, nothing positive came out of that for the people other than the cessation of conflict, as you mentioned, Louise. So we work with women on the grassroots level, and when you ask them, do you do peace building, do you work on peace building, they say, no, definitely not peace building. Okay, but we do humanitarian response, education, reconciliation, we work with communities, we combat arms, we do that. So it's the absolute definition of peace building, but they'd like to phrase it differently and use different terminology. Unfortunately, the international response to that have failed to understand this very simple point. I'll give a quick example our partners in Syria and in other places around the region have been combating violent extremism very long before the global north realized it's a thing that needs combating. But unfortunately, for so many reasons, they cannot apply for funding to combat violent extremism because that's connected to other elements of the society that they don't want to associate themselves with. But international donors and states deny them the agency of continuing the work that they do, which results in combating violent extremism in an organic, long-term, useful ways, and demand that it's done in the one template that international donors and states understand. So that's an example, and I have many of these. The other thing is that women in Syria have been leading one fight against both violence and patriarchy. And as much as we know the intersection between these, the tools that they have developed, large scope and scale of tools that I found extremely educational to us at the international feminist movement. Ones that include, you know, a lot of the pure pacifist actions that many people around the world, including in dictatorships, can use, unfortunately are not possible because 2 minutes into your demonstration, half of the people in it would be shot dead. So they developed new ways of doing this. And that has led to a very good movement and a diverse movement, but has also, unfortunately, had led to a large NGOization of activism. Because when their work is no longer something that you can do as a volunteer for 2 hours after after your full-time job, it had to take over their lives. And the only way we can understand it, we internationally, I mean, can understand that kind of work, is by the one frame that we understand. It has to be an NGO which gets funding and produce reports and has media and communication the way we understand it. That has been helpful in some of the cases. It has been really devastating to the movement in so many other cases, where it's small groups that manage to work in small scale in areas, in besieged areas, in remote areas, in areas where you most need this work, have not been able to fit within the one template that we understand. And also, a lot of the threats, I'm going to make it very quick, but a lot of the threats that they have to combat, unfortunately, has been made in the name of peace. And I'll give you a few examples. When the track one political process for peace has not been developing, although grassroots women activists have been given the international community and us at the international NGOs and activists around the world the ways of how this would have worked and have been ignored systematically. But then when it didn't work, the only way that men in power understand how to take over things was by shift the entire peace process into, well, when we put everyone at a table, it didn't work, so let's take warlords and people who are mainly controlling territory. And this is how men understand war. They control territory. Suddenly, they took all the men who control territory to a setana, an entire different scene from the one that women civil society have been trying to gain access to for 7 years. And then they decided to build peace there. And that obviously failed miserably. But as it failed, it also sidelined women completely emptied the activism that they have working and the advocacy and lobbying work that they also had to learn from scratch and master over the years, their connection with the decision makers, because physically there was no place for them and the criteria did not include anything that's related to them. Controlling territory, being able to, having access to armed groups and so on, which is none of the things that they have any interest in. And that's the peace building process in Syria that that alienated and isolated them. So it's also important to realize what is working for peace and what's working for stopping the hostilities, which, by the way, did not stop the hostilities, but that's for another conversation. I'm gonna stop here, but and maybe later we go back to the tools, the pacifist tools versus other tools women use. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So thank you, Leila. So you know, I mean, I can sit here listening to all your accounts, and I'm gonna go slightly off message from the first question that I had because I just want to pick up on a couple of things here. All three of you are describing the context, the history of your respective countries, and painting this picture of an enlightened, you know, sort of woman's history, where women were educated once, where women were free, liberated, etc., empowered, okay? And then, whether it is due to conflict or to other external forces, internal forces, suddenly women are stripped of their rights. And so, you know, to link this back into the question that I had was, in my introduction, I stated that the risks women take as activists is always gendered. And to a certain extent, you've all already touched on this. And I just wanted to invite you to elaborate on that. But also, the two other themes that seem to come from all three of your narratives. There is this complete sort of lack of understanding, this the divide between, or the gap between, the international and the local, okay, the non-understanding of and the focus of the international, and the international wanting to already frame the situation according to one narrative, and not seeing, not only not seeing women, but not seeing the different women and the different experiences. And perhaps you'd like to elaborate on that. But also, last week I was speaking to some women from Yemen who were talking about these parallel processes, ongoing processes. You, Zeynep, you say the formal processes, and yet the informal processes where the women are really active and are making such a difference on the ground. And that's been missed completely, not only by the international community, but very often by scholars, you know? So perhaps, you know, you'd like to pick up on some of those items. Would you like to?
Sure. Okay, so I was, when I initially mentioned, and I'm Zeynep, you touched on this, that again, women in Iran, because the political elite is male-dominated, and the majority of the political elite, yes, you have progressive-minded ones, but the predominant political elite have maintained stereotypical assumptions about what women can and cannot do. And this obviously impacts women's activism, and although women who are at the forefront of this type of activism are not only pushing to change the gender discriminatory laws, but they're also pushing for more women to be included in typically male-dominated fields, because they feel that is one avenue where if there are more women, they are able to implement change. But, for example, if you look at the Iranian parliament, there's 290 members currently. Out of the 290 members, there's only 18 female parliamentary members. And women are continuously 9 out of 10 times blocked from being able to implement change or reverse policies that are against women. So when you talk about gendered, yes, of course it's gendered. It's gendered when you live in a country that says women are not capable of running for president or serving as judges. That is gendered. Women don't have the capacity. It's gendered when, on the one hand, you have a regime that hails women as custodians of the private sphere and says their primary role is to be that of wife and mother, but at the same time they defraud them within the laws of child custody cases, in divorce cases. You have a society that literally thinks that in a court of law, a woman's testimony counts for half that of a man's. I mean, this is what these women are up against. So when you, Leila, talk about women in war efforts, women in other arenas, there are no women. You know, the dominant military elite, the IRGC in Iran, is completely male-dominated. So when I say that women's activism is really, at this point, limited to regaining their rights, this is what the challenges they're dealing with. So one avenue, and you mentioned gendered, yes, what's become really the symbol, and it's been a very, in my opinion, a very, I don't want to say smart, but very astute way to gain the attention of the international community, because Louise, you mentioned the international community a lot of time leaves out the narrative. So the narrative with Iran, when you look at mainstream media, when you look at what they highlight, is they really tend to highlight Iran's revolutionary leaders. Pre-revolution, post-revolution, it's all centered on the political elite and leaves out the narratives of not only women, but also ordinary people in Iran. So what has been happening in terms of gendered is the veil. The question of the veil in Iran has taken center stage, especially in Iran and where the international community is concerned, specifically the criminalization of women and girls for choosing not to wear the veil. Now, if you look at all the gender discriminatory laws in Iran, the veil is really the least of their problems. But why has the veil taken center stage specifically since 2014? Because it constitutes the most visible form of oppression. So Iranian women have actually zeroed in. So this is almost four, this year actually marks four decades of rule by the Islamic Republic. Just in 2014, given a voice by women's rights activists working on the outside, Iranian women's activists, such as prominent Iranian journalist Masi Ali Nejad, who left Iran in 2009. She was one of the very few female journalists actually allowed to cover issues in the parliament. She defected and started in 2014 an online movement called My Stealthy Freedom, which is against the Iran's compulsory veiling laws. That turned into White Wednesday's campaign. And recently, we have the Girls of Revolution Street campaign, which actually started in late December 2017. Iran, since December 2017, has experienced a series of nationwide protests, and women took advantage of this and actually took the lead. We had a 31-year-old woman named Vida Movahed who decided to take a white piece of cloth symbolizing the veil. White, again, symbol for peace, because mostly women are wearing the black veil. And she went on a very busy street called Revolution Street. She got up on a utility box and tied her white headscarf on a stick and started to wave it in protest. Now, Vida has suffered tremendous consequences for this action, but that started a whole movement, which is actually has its own hashtag on social media, Girls of Revolution Street, where even not only, hundreds of women joined in this process and also some men, and all of which have been arrested. But the veil, again, when you mentioned gendered, that has become the symbol of Iranian women's struggle for freedom, and recently culminating in the arrest and imprisonment of prominent Iranian attorney Nasrin Sotoudeh, who was given the harshest sentence ever in Iran for a human rights defender. She was given a 38-year sentence plus 148 lashes. Why? Her crime? Some of these women hired her to defend them. So now in Iran, what I'm saying is you cannot even, they're deterring women from hiring lawyers to represent them. The case of Nasrin got significant attention initially from international women's rights organizations and also human rights organizations, including Amnesty. We were all, bunch of us were asked to hold placards saying Free Nasrin hashtag. But unfortunately, that died down. And I was speaking earlier to a colleague, and I said, these issues I need to be continuously spotlighted by the international community, meaning you can't mention it, gloss over it, and leave it. Why? Because this woman is given a 38-year sentence. Why? For practicing law. That has never happened, and that sets a new tone for Iran's repressive judiciary. And I think this is something that the international community, specifically women's rights organizations, really need to rally for support. France did an exceptional job. They actually put up a huge billboard near the Champs-Élysées with Nasreen's photo and Free Nasreen. I think more countries need to do this. Why? Because if the trials and tribulations of these women are not continuously highlighted, there's not much hope for them, in all honesty. And, you know, they never resort to violence. They're always peaceful in their activism. But again, unfortunately, we tend to be complacent on the outside when it comes to this. So I'm...
Can I pick up on something you've just said? Because
yeah.
you just you know, described how the strategies that
mm-hmm.
women are using
mm-hmm.
in Iran
mm-hmm.
to assert their rights, which, you know, gender equality is,
right.
is clearly seen as part of a broader understanding of
mm-hmm.
what peace entails.
Exactly.
And it's important here because I want to pick up, you know, Zeynep as well as Leyla, this idea of feminist strategies, women's peace movements, because there's always this going to be this tension between to what extent do we actually resort to arms, to
mm-hmm.
violence, in order to gain our rights. You know, what's your experience here in that, you know, how do you reconcile that tension between your ambitions, peace, gender equality, and your means of getting there?
Mm-hmm. I think, like Leyla said, the conception of peace is different, and it depends on which women's society you're talking about. So for a Yazidi woman, peace means retribution. It changes from context to context. And for civil society organizations, they carry on work on women's rights organizations, but in Iraq, there are a couple of organizations that directly relate their work on women's rights and working for gender equality to peace, to the concept of peace, because they believe that if the society is not fair, peace is not achievable. But there are also organizations who don't necessarily, who kind of have this division and see peace and security as a,
mm-hmm.
it depends. So I wouldn't be able to generalize to the whole of Iraqi women's organizations that this is what they do.
You know, just as quickly, can I just quickly say, women in Iran, for example, are not at the negotiating table. They're not at any negotiating table. Even when you have a few token women, they're not listened to. They're not spoken to. They are just literally, I feel it's more of a window dressing.
Yep.
The other component is when you have, in terms of Iran, when you have 50% of the population that has been debilitated by a plethora of gender discrimination, who can't possibly, and they continue to pay a harsh penalty, continue to face violence. A couple of years ago, women were subject to acid attacks for being improperly veiled. When you have a society where 50% of the women are vying for their freedom, how can you have peace within a society that continuously battles 50% of its population?
I think, Leyla, you're nodding here. So.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I'm a pacifist. I'll always believe in pacifist means, and I think it's the only way for us to achieve peace or to sustain a civilized community. At the same time, it's really important to clarify the difference between methods and means. Pacifist methods are very much needed. When it comes to means, we need to look at what's available. And I think, particularly learning from Syria, it's the worst thing we could do is to confine the burden of pacifism on vulnerable civilians. So when we are unable to control the armed proliferation and the export of arms to the country, and the relationship between major powers and how that's resulting in uncontrolled arm production and transfer to countries, and the denying civilians the legal or physical means to protect themselves, and then we wait for the first person to hold a kitchen knife, and then we say because it's easier for the word to say, you know, this is in some Middle Eastern country. It's a terrible regime, but also the people are armed. It's a conflict between two groups that are equally bad. They use methods that we wouldn't use here in London, and then it becomes easy. It becomes less of an ethical dilemma. Mm. So we need to look at what options were people given in the tools they use, but also in the alliances they made. I wouldn't make an alliance with an armed group, no matter what, but I enjoy the safety of not having to. Unfortunately, we left big portions of civilians, particularly women who need to survive. They need their daily safety to survive, but also to have some impact. Mm-hmm. They need alliances. They need to work within this community, which we left no space in it except for power, misogynistic power, and hyper-masculinity. So until we all work together to change this dynamic of power, we need to understand the choices that women take within the context they're given.
Thank you, Leila. I'm going to open it up to the audience
because
I'm sure there are people
but
here who would like...
But can I just
say
one thing which is so important, which Leila said I wanted to, because you touched on this. When women are actively pursuing an agenda in an environment where they don't feel safe, okay, that you brought up safety, that again is something that needs to be considered. How do you provide safety for women who are peacefully advocating for their rights?
Yeah. So thank you
for bringing that up.
Can I open it up to the audience? Would you like to share your name, affiliation, and you can either, you know, sort of ask your question to individual people or to the whole panel. So I'm going to take three at a time. So. Thank you for that really difficult question.
Hi, my name is Faye Minchell. I head up the Gender and Conflict team at the Foreign Office. Firstly, it's really, really interesting to hear from all of you, so thank you so much. My question is about a criticism that I hear quite a lot, which I find frustrating, a lot of the women who, when they are involved in any form of peace process, they're seen as being elite women who have a very privileged background potentially, they're the only ones who can speak English or whatever. So my question is, how do we bridge the gap between those elite women, as they say, and those other, the normal women who are, you know, in their communities doing that kind of grassroots peace building? Really interesting.
Thank you. Can I invite anyone else, or should we just, okay, we're going to take those questions and the rest of you can be thinking about what else you'd like to. Would any of you like to begin to answer any of those?
Mm-hmm. In terms of... this comes a lot in the context of Iraq. The most of the not only the peace building work, but also any kind of work that has an international window, you see the key people. You know that they come to the same meeting again and again, and so what I think there's a lot of work the local embassies could do to expand their network. I know it's hard in Baghdad; they can't even leave the compound. But there are ways of navigating those and reaching out to other women's organizations that are carrying out work, like basically expanding the network. So through those civil society organizations, they might be able to have access to the needs and priorities of non-elite women. Because it's hard to say elite women, I mean, they do touch on important issues, but it's hard to, you know, the wider the context,
the conversation is being, the wider the audience or the people that they are talking to, the better. Another thing that they could be done in the context of Women, Peace and Security Agenda, the NAP, the consultations with regards to NAP, they are quite narrow most of the time. And again, international community, the UK just works with the UN Women in Iraq and certain actors rather than most of the other actors. And the national actors who are actually working on the National Action Plan don't necessarily do much consultation within their own, so on the ground. So that those are ways to bridge that gap. In terms of the methods that work like this, thanks. I don't know.
Talk to the women. Leila, would you like to come in on either of those questions?
So safety concerns and effective results. Very difficult question, but I can come with a few things that we've tried and so far have worked. I think it's important to finally support the feminist movement building efforts and to create a space where women can use feminist tools to achieve their impact. And I don't mean that in the academic and, if you want to call it, elitist sense of the word. I mean, if we don't allow for groups to work in the diversity of their tools, from very small groups to the elite women you were mentioning, if you want to call them so, and create the connections between them and admit that it's feminist tools we're looking for, not women doing things, because that's very different. It does make all the difference. These can be channeled through the way we look at supporting women, the tools we use, the spaces we make available, and how much effort and importance we put on feminist solidarity, both locally and internationally. Which takes me to your question, which we think of and get asked about all the time. Hyper-masculinity and misogynistic environment in politics is everywhere. However, in certain spaces, it's so often that the only women who can handle such attacks are women with a social capital and social spaces that allow them to do so. I'll just give you a few examples. In Syria and in other countries in the region, the women who dare to want to represent or represent other women or represent their community have faced everything from physical threats, death threats, made up revenge porn, you name it. The social media has become so hostile. I don't think it's humanly possible to deal with all of this. So you end up with people with such a social capital and such the ability to, and it's not something I would request, I would expect all women to be able to deal with. So we need to deal with this environment. We need to deal with an environment that deals with hostility to women in public spaces as just a collateral damage. It's not. It's deterring women from being in all public spaces, let alone politics. The second thing is the more simple logistical issues that you mentioned, including language and visas and so on. It took us so many years to convince decision makers that it's about the women, you need to speak their language, not the other way around, and that's going places now. But now we have a major visa issue. Women have less ability to, and it's not because all people from this country have a visa issue, it's because women have less access to documentation, to their embassies, so on and so forth. So they are not as mobile, and we need to make, and that could be remedied by online. One of our Yemeni partners just briefed the UN Security Council over video because they wanted to hear from her, but they didn't want to give her a visa. So we create spaces for that to work, and this is really easy and straightforward. And the third thing is back to the feminist movement building. If we don't want women who are single-handedly able to face this misogynistic attack, we need to strengthen the feminist movement in order for them to take the hit together. And that happens through, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, we're a tiny organization, but we're 105 years old. So we've seen quite a bit. And supporting the feminist movement is not as massive and as costly as it sounds. We use a fraction of the funding available to humanitarian action or to combating violent extremism, and it takes us places with supporting feminist movement. So it's just the agreement that the F word, feminism, is fine. We need to support that, and we need to create spaces for women to be able to create their network and to connect and to be stronger together, and to also for all of us to take our spaces as an international women's solidarity movement that has a role to play when women are getting attacked at this scale.
Would you like to respond to any of the questions?
Yes, absolutely. In terms of women's safety, what's been very instrumental for specifically women in Iran is the advent of social media. Social media has really created a portal for even the most oppressive women and girls to forge meaningful connections with the outside world. If I told you the countless number of women who follow me and send me material from Iran, it has been a godsend for them, because Iran likes to block social media. Iran likes to undertake their atrocities against women in silence. That is how they have been able to. Social media has been a nightmare for this regime. Why? Because it has enabled the international community, feminists on the outside, to spotlight specifically what they do to their women. So in terms of solidarity, and we talked about feminist solidarity, that's a very important medium for disseminating this kind of information. The other thing is, I need to be careful, because a lot of women in Iran, the word feminist in Iran, where this regime is concerned, is a Western terminology and considered incompatible with Sharia law. You have a supreme leader who actually says gender equality is one of the biggest misconceptions in the West. Okay, so I just said this because I want to show you what women are up against. Okay, so in avoiding this terminology, a lot of women's rights activists have been able to make strides over the years. By simply, if you use the feminist terminology, you're not going to get anywhere in Iran. So when I advocate on their behalf, people say you don't refer to yourself as a feminist. There's a strategic reason for that. If I do refer to myself as a feminist and these women reach out to me, I refer to myself as a women's rights or human rights advocate. And then it's actually when I advocate on their behalf on the outside and bypass using a Western terminology, it's more helpful to these women. So sometimes I get accused of, why don't you call yourself a feminist? It's only in consideration and in solidarity with the women of Iran who are trying to not only regain their rights, but their dignity as well.
I actually do have a follow-up question myself, but I don't want to be selfish. Is there anyone who wants to go? Yeah, please do.
Hi, my name is Shida. I'm from Iran. I'm one of those mechanical engineers, oil and gas, worked in refineries in Iran. So as you said, you can go and change and do things, but to an extent. And then I studied LSE, social business. My question is a bit of an unfair question, that what do you think is the negative role of women, especially in Iran, because I know Iran, of not making change? So probably the elites, the activists are working hard, mm-hmm. but I don't think the masses are. The economic problems, all of that is pushing everybody really hard, so the masses of women are not supporting. So Nasrin Sotoudeh could be out, women should be in the streets right now and making a lot of noise for some change, but they're not doing that. So what do you think is a negative role of women?
Can I hold your response to that? Because I saw one other hand go up at the back, and I'm going to take that question too, because we've only got a few minutes, so the others can think about how to respond to the second question.
So how do you want us to?
Okay.
Who goes first? Who?
Go on, Nina. Go for it.
Okay, so you, what is your name again?
Shida.
So first of all, women are on the streets in Iran. As I mentioned, they are getting arrested left, right, and center. They are handed harsh penalties in the hopes that it will derail them from continuing their activism. They're not derailed. 4 decades has proven that they're resilient, they're determined as ever. But you have to realize they're up against the Basij, the Revolutionary Guards. These are the the military arm of the Islamic Republic and the hardliners that are currently in power. So despite that, that is not derailing women. They are out on the streets, as is evident by the nationwide protests that started in late December 2017 and continues till this day. But the other thing, and I wanted to mention, is the question of the sanctions in Iran, and I'm glad you brought this up because this ties in. When the U.S. comes and treads the Iran deal and it reinforces the sanctions, that does not debilitate the regime. That debilitates the average person. So I am not in favor of any laws that put pressure on people. I'm in favor of laws that put pressure on this regime to change their behavior, specifically towards ordinary people, and that includes women. But when you have a Iranian civil society that is not only debilitated by the regime, but also debilitated by policies implemented by the international community, where can these people go? Okay, our policies on the outside, our job on the outside, and I'm right now talking about human rights, not just women's rights, is to empower Iranian civil society. When you debilitate society, which is what this regime has done for four decades, and you compound it by adding more pressure on them from the outside because you think what you're doing is in effect going to debilitate the regime or get the regime to alter its behavior, that's not going to happen. The key is to empower Iranian civil society, and that includes women, and I'm really glad you brought this up. In terms of books, she wanted a book.
Okay.
I would recommend Marjana Satrapi's book, Persepolis, if you wanted to get a broad range of a very first-hand autobiographical account of pre-revolution and post-revolutionary Iran. It's an amazing book, and it's in numerous volumes, so I would really recommend that. Yeah, Persepolis, the movie, it came out in 2007 and won every award you can imagine. So I would really recommend it. It's a graphic memoir, but it's visual and also a very eye-opening because Marjana lived, the author herself, lived through the revolution. So it's eye-opening in terms of what she saw, the direct impact this revolution had on women in the immediate aftermath, especially when they were all their rights were revoked.
Okay, so Zainab, I'm going to bring you in here because I know you were wanting to say something specific.
What do I look like?
Yeah, you know, no, because I think what something that Nina and also Leila mentioned is the reference to feminist agendas and you know, one of the questions that I had posed to all three of you was that we're now encountering this backlash. And how useful is it to use this kind of language in the context within which you operate, whether it's an academic or other women pacifists?
So there is no denying that the international normative agenda on gender, women, feminism also comes with hard power in some contexts. So the hard power and these norms sometimes intersect, not deliberately, but in the context of Iraq, with the intervention with Afghanistan, and the local anti-US or anti-Western or more conservative, whatever you call them, sections of the society, in order to justify their actions, have kind of utilized this overlap to their advantage, saying, well, this is coming from the West, and that's what they did to us, so we rejected all. So that's kind of, it's a very powerful tool they are using, and it's been effective. There is no denying that. I think it's very important to be aware of that, and then somehow we'll find a way of, in our language, disassociate that kind of agenda from other hard powers. So that's kind of the relationship between international politics. You cannot get rid of it. You cannot overlook it. Somehow it affects. I think the other factor, like with the backlash, when I was in Baghdad a couple of months ago, just during that time, a very well-known feminist activist, women's rights activist, was killed on the street. And I met with a guy who was kind of ex-militant, you know, but now consultant type of thing. So I wanted to get his perspective on why was that woman shot? What happened? Is it because she's working on women's rights and she's, you know, fighting against discrimination? No. She was too Western. You know, that wasn't. There's nothing to do with her being woman. Nothing to do with that.
It's about her. She was, because she was Western.
So that, you know, we need to be really aware of that. So mm-hmm. sometimes I think the international actors might be creating risks for women on the ground by claiming that this is their agenda. I know they are not saying this, but it appears like that. Whereas women's rights activism have been there in that region for a very long time. It's authentic. It's there. It's just, you know, it's not a new idea. So we are not really going and changing the world. And there is not one form of feminism. There are multiple feminisms. Mm-hmm. So what are the manifestations of feminism in that context? What is they called? What do they do to execute it? And then how do we understand that? And then tap to those sources as international actors rather than creating these risks for them. I think that's the way it says. So there is no, going back to your question, there is no easy answers to that question. And these things will not change. You can't say this works because these are long-term issues and structural inequalities that are in place. It will take time, but I think this is, that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you, Zainab. Okay, so I'm glad you finished on the terms long-term structural issues, because it's not just in Syria, Iran, Iraq that we, you know, feminists face the structure, the gendered structures, that oppress. And we face them here in this country, and to a certain extent, we're doing battle every single day. But if we're doing battle, so do the women 100 years ago. And I say this because I want to invite you all to join all of us to go upstairs when this event finishes, where we're actually going to have a reception with serving tea and scones. But up there we have a new exhibition, and it's a really important exhibition. And this one follows on from the library's exhibition on giving peace a chance. And this new exhibition is actually called The Sacred Year 1919, Women and the Professions. The sacred year 1919 actually marks the centenary of the Sex Disqualification Removal Act. Now, this act enabled women to enter in this country most professions and professional bodies for the very first time. And so the exhibition basically celebrates the pioneering women who first entered male-dominated professions such as the law, accountancy, the church, the sciences and the arts. And there were many obstacles, as you can imagine, and the exhibition hopefully will show us some of the obstacles the women faced and how they broke down these barriers 100 years ago in this country. So on that note, do join us all upstairs, and please join me in thanking our three speakers. Thank you, Leila. Thank you.